we have the power to do anything we like. Absolute power over every particle in the universe. Everything that has ever existed or ever will exist. As from this moment. Are you listening to me, Romana?
Yes, of course I'm listening.
Because if you're not listening, I can make you listen. Because I can do anything. As from this moment, there's no such thing as free will in the entire universe. There's only my will, because I possess the key to time.
Doctor, are you all right?
Well, of course I'm all right, but suppose I wasn't all right. Well, this thing makes me feel in such a way, I'd be very worried if I felt like that, if I was somebody else feeling like this about that. Do you understand?
Yes.
What do you understand?
That the sooner we hand this over to the White Guardian, the better.
In Greek mythology, the curse of the House of Atreus is still spoken about in hushed tones. Tantalus, the grandfather of Atreus, was cursed by the gods and banished to the underworld. No, not that underworld. I know what you Doctor Who fans are thinking. Banished to the underworld for eternity. One famous and especially cursed member of the House of Atreus was Agamemnon. Yes, that Agamemnon, although in Doctor Who's The Mythmakers, the curse wasn't featured. The curse of the House of Atreus was broken by Agamemnon's son Orestes. No, not Orestes Estrada. I know what you 1990s baseball fans are thinking. And how did Orestes break the curse? By, killing his mother? Okay, that's dark. But not nearly as dark as what happens to the similarly named House of Atreus in Doctor Who's The Armageddon Factor. Princess Astra has to pay a pretty high price to escape that curse. How high? Well, you might say Armageddon itself.
Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations, put out by Target Books from 1973 onward, in publication order. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. Welcome to the second full week of the year 2023, and I have been fairly glued to the television, but not to watch Doctor Who, which is not going to be returning to our screens properly until the end of the calendar year. No, here in the United States, I've been watching C-SPAN, the network covering all proceedings in Congress, and the House of Representatives had a rancorous debate for Speaker of the House. This is a generally formal, ceremonial election that occurs every 2 years with the outcome already predetermined. For the first time in 100 years, there was a contested election which took more than one ballot, and it took 15 ballots to resolve in the wee hours of Friday night / Saturday morning, Eastern time, and this was the first time since 1859 when it took this many ballots to elect one Speaker of the House. At the time of recording, the current Speaker of the House is Kevin McCarthy, Representative Republican from California. By the time this episode releases, of course, that may no longer be the case, so we will see what we will see. When Doctor Who comes back later in the year, it might not necessarily be as dramatic as the Speaker of the House election, which featured a near fistfight on the House floor in the wee hours of Saturday morning, and a fiery speech by my fellow Brooklynite, Hakeem Jeffries, who is now the House Minority Leader in the Democratic Party. But you're not here to listen to politics, you're here to talk about Doctor Who. Just consider this equal time for the states after all the time that we spent on this podcast in the year 2022, talking about the several British Prime Ministers who came and went throughout that year. So we'll see what happens in 2023. Will there be more Speakers of the House than British Prime Ministers over the next 12 months? I am very excited this week to introduce a first-time guest, Paul Scoones, who has had many roles to play in Doctor Who fandom over the last 30 years. We're going to talk about almost all of them. We are also in the final week of our Key to Time miniseason. We're covering the final story of Doctor Who's classic series, Season 16, the Key to Time season, by discussing the Armageddon Factor. of course, given Paul's curriculum vitae, it'll be a while before we get to discussion of the episode and book itself. And then at the end of the program is my review of Terrence Dix's novelization of Doctor Who and the Armageddon Factor. Next week, we will be done with The Key to Time, and we'll be traveling backwards to discover an earlier Doctor. But for now, we want to talk about Atrios, Zeos, the Shadow, the Black Guardian, and the arrival in the Doctor Who universe of one Lala Ward. Let's get to it.
The vervoids are probably the best dirty joke in Doctor Who.
They're hermaphroditic plants.
A lot of plants are.
So there you go. Let's see, it's based on science.
No, they'll ship anything.
There are probably 11 and handle shippers out there. You just have to drill a hole where his mouth is, and you're all set.
You know he needs the room. I've seen it in pictures.
I'm not saying you're not a fan. I'm saying you don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Doctor Who gives a fuck. A drunken Doctor Who podcast for the end times.
So I am very happy to be joined today by the New Zealand contingent of my listening audience. Paul Schoons, thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
My first question, you've probably heard this many times before, but I legitimately don't know the answer. Any relation to Ian Schoons, veteran of many, many Doctor Who closing credit sequences in the 1970s?
Absolutely. We are related 5 generations back, I think it is.
Wow.
Yeah. It took me a while to make the connection. Unfortunately, while he was alive, because he passed away a few years ago, I couldn't make that connection. I did actually write to him, and he didn't know we were related, and I didn't know we were related. But I've since done a lot of extensive family tree research and connected with a number of other Schoons branches, and we've obviously pasted them all together and got quite a huge number of Schoons all into the same family tree, which is quite exciting. And there he is. So I was quite excited, but also disappointed because obviously I can't share that with him now that he's no longer around. But yes, definitely. But it was quite exciting growing up and like as a kid watching Doctor Who and occasionally seeing this, you know, it's a fairly unusual name to see it on the end credits and go, oh, another Schoons, Doctor Who.
See, my last name is Miller, which is much, much more common. And I don't have any relations to any of the Millers who have appeared in Doctor Who or worked on Doctor Who or Sadie Miller over the years. So that, I guess, is a tragedy on my part.
I have another couple of Schoons connections as well. The recent Jodie Whittaker, Who Do You Think You Are documentary is actually produced by one of my cousins, Eleanor Schoons. And as I discovered not so long ago for a friend of a friend, Russell T Davies actually named a character after me in Doctor Who. Mr. Schoons and the Next Doctor is actually named for me.
You know, I was wondering the last time that I watched that about a year ago as part of my pilgrimage. That's very exciting.
I didn't want to ask, but then the opportunity came up, a friend of a friend. It's kind of like, I've got to ask. I can't not know. But there we go.
I had a couple of characters named for me in the New Adventures / Eighth Doctor Adventures. Not quite as high profile as getting on the main show, The Mothership.
I'm not sure if I mean, I know quite a few of the New Adventures authors, but I don't know if I was ever used in a book. That's an interesting thing. Maybe my name's too distinctive.
Being on Rec Art's Doctor Who in the early 90s, when the New Adventures authors were starting to cycle into the chat, there was a lot of opportunities for Rec Art's users to get their names in books. So there are whole books that are guided tours of the Rec Art's Doctor Who community, most notably Human Nature, Happy Endings, any book by Kate Orman.
Yes, I used to correspond with Kate Orman quite regularly, as a lot of people did. So, yeah, happy memories.
So is your family native to New Zealand, or did you have a branch that was in England before settling where you are now?
No, I'm English. I was born in London, and my family moved to New Zealand when I was 5 years old. So, yeah, we're relatively new to New Zealand.
But in time for you to acquire the distinctive accent.
Yes. though New Zealanders will tell me to this day, 50 years later that I still have a slightly British accent.
My accent has bounced all over the map because I've lived in so many different states. I grew up on Long Island, which is a New York City suburb, which has a very distinctive accent. Then I went away to other parts of the country for many years for school, and I lost that accent. And now my accent is kind of a mishmash of three or four different states.
Sure.
And I can turn up certain parts of it if I need to for emphasis. But for this podcast, I try to be as a distinctive native Brooklyn accent as possible.
My wife tells me that when we go over to the UK and we visit friends and relatives over there, that I start sounding more and more British the longer I'm there.
It's funny how the voice plays tricks on us. Mm. So you were on an episode of the companion podcast to this show, the Doctor Who Target Book Club podcast, and Tony and I are part of the same network. So I've heard an interview with you recently with Tony over on the other podcast. What I don't want to do is cover all the same ground that Tony covered with you fairly recently. But looking at your bio, there is certainly an awful lot to discuss before we get to this week's book, which is the novelization of The Armageddon Factor. So you have written about Doctor Who in magazines and in book form. You have appeared on some of the DVDs. You have written widely available fandom novelizations of some of the unnovelized stories through your New Zealand fanzine, the Time Space Visualizer, TSV. And you also have quite a part to play in the DVD range, having written the text note commentaries for several stories, which is a sea change in the way that I think about and watch classic Doctor Who now. Because if I'm watching Doctor Who without the text commentary on, even if it's a commentary that I've read several times before, I still feel like I'm getting only half the story. So I can't watch Doctor Who without the commentaries now.
Bless you. There are people who have all the Blu-rays and DVDs and have never watched the info text. So I really appreciate that you make that effort.
I can't imagine doing it any other way. And that's one of the first questions that I want to ask you, because not only have you done several text commentaries for Peter Davison, Colin Baker, and Sylvester McCoy stories, you are also instrumental in the recovery of Episode 1 of The Crusade, which just came out. I'm looking at it across the room now, my Series 2 Blu-ray collection box set. I am only on Disc 3. I am only up to The Rescue right now, working through the Maureen O'Brien sit-down with Matthew Sweet. But did you do any work, such as perhaps a commentary for The Crusade on that DVD collection?
Yes. Yes, there is a commentary on The Lion, which was my idea, actually. I pitched it to Russell Minton, who manages the range. And obviously, you know, I'm already known to them because I work on the infotech, so I wasn't a complete stranger pitching an idea. And I just said, well, this would be a clever thing to do, would be to have a commentary. It was obviously quite difficult to get us all together, but the magic of the internet is that people from various parts of the world could just all get together online and just record a commentary. We actually went over time. We had the episode playing like you do when you're recording an episode commentary. But fortunately, because we didn't comment on anything we were seeing on screen, because we were basically spent the whole time telling the story of the discovery, it meant that because we were still talking after the credits rolled, that the director of the commentary could go and re-edit it and just chop bits out to make it fit the same length as the episode. So that was quite fortuitous because there was so much to talk about. And we had myself and my good friend Neil Lambis and Bruce Grenville, who owned the film, and Steve Roberts, who did the restoration work, and the wonderful Toby Haydoke was moderating us and asking the questions. So there was quite a few voices to fit into that 24 minutes or however long it was.
I'm tempted now to go out of story order and watch that next, but I'm trying to be as in self-control as I can be. So I am still right on The Rescue. I'm still a few discs away from getting to The Crusade, but you have me very excited now.
Oh yeah. Watch them all in order. I think you'll appreciate it better that way.
So when I watch the text commentaries, I sometimes have work-related anxiety over the effort that it must take to research that and then write it in such a way that you often sync up text captions with specific lines of dialogue. How long does it take to put together the production note commentary for a four-part or 4x25-minute Doctor Who serial?
Wow. Sometimes the time stretches and sometimes it contracts because it depends how long there is between the commission and when the deadline is. Because sometimes these things get moved up and sometimes they get moved back. I delivered a set of commentary notes for a Blu-ray set, and I'm being careful here because I can't say which one it is, two, three years ago. It was during the first lockdown for COVID, right at the beginning. So yeah, 2020 probably. Still hasn't been announced. So yeah, sometimes these things get massively delayed. So we had the opportunity to obviously to go back and retweak that one. So I've been sitting on that one for a very long time. And then other ones, particularly with the DVD range, they'd be very tight. I remember doing Resurrection of the Daleks in about 3 weeks from beginning to end. That was very intense. Generally, I have about 3 months to work on it, but that's not a solid 3 months. That's taking my time and doing a bit each day, maybe a couple of hours a day on it. And then obviously, as we get close to deadline, I might spend the entire day working on them. It is, as you say, quite intensive and very detail-obsessed work because I get a time-coded video of each episode, and that's basically with a sort of counting by frames. So I can say it's specifically exactly when a subtitle appears on screen by the frame and then when it comes off again. And generally they're on for about 6 or 7 seconds each, depending on the length of them. So yeah, it's quite difficult to time it. And you can have the dual frustration that sometimes you've got so much to say about something that is on screen for a very short period of time. So how do you fit that in? And then there were also long periods of an episode where you really struggle for anything to say about what's on screen because there's really nothing to say about it. So it can be either really compacted or really expanded depending on what you're working with.
How does one become involved in the recovery of a missing episode that is thought to have been wiped and lost forever?
It was pure circumstance. My friend Neil Lambis was the one who made he did the detective work and made the initial contact with Bruce Grenville, who owned the film. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. Neil and I were very old friends. We've been friends for a very long time. And Neil had arranged with Bruce to go around and watch the episode, and he'd asked if he could set up a video camera and record the episode off the projection screen. Not a very good method, but, you know, the best he could arrange, because obviously Neil was never sure if he'd ever get to see it again. Didn't know if we'd be able to borrow it, didn't know if Bruce was going to allow anyone else to see it. So Neil's thinking was, if this is the only time, I need to be able to get a copy of it. So he contacted me because he knew I had a video camera. That's as simple as that. If I hadn't had a video camera, he probably wouldn't have contacted me. But I drove and he didn't drive as well, so he needed to be able to get to Bruce's place. So yeah, I was a taxi service as well, should we say. And I think he wanted strength in numbers. He wanted someone to go along with him. He didn't know Bruce. I didn't know Bruce. So, you know. So we went along together and we watched the episode and we reshot it on my video camera. And then fortunately, Neil doesn't live in Auckland where Bruce and I lived. So Neil had to go back home to where he lived. And I was left with talking to Bruce and arranging the return, because at that point we hadn't reached an agreement with Bruce to actually return the episode to the BBC. So my big part of the whole recovery thing is arranging and negotiating the return and then actually getting the episode back to the BBC.
And now I was reading before this conversation your article in TSV issue 57, where you talk about the circumstances of the discovery and the recovery and the negotiation and the transfer. there's a very funny story involved that when you arrived at Bruce's house, he was in the middle of screening something else that ran very long that you didn't want to watch.
There's a movie called Veronica Voss, which is quite a long black and white movie, if I remember rightly. Very boring. Boring to me anyway. I mean, the story's gone back and forth over the years, as things tend to do in the retellings. And talking to Bruce while we were setting up the commentary, I went through it with him again. I don't think it's actually on the commentary itself. I could be mistaken. Maybe it is on there, but I think it's while we were setting up that we're talking about it. Because initially I thought that we were being wound up. I thought that Bruce was just, you know, playing this movie, and at the end it was all going to be, ha ha, this is all a hoax, because we didn't know for certain that Bruce had an episode of Doctor Who. So I thought this was just an elaborate hoax. It was kind of, let's just string these people along and make them give a laugh about it. And then obviously, you know, that turned out not to be the case. And then so for years I would tell the story of Bruce just stringing us along and making us wait and everything. And then it occurred to me that because this was in the middle of New Zealand summer, it's actually 24 years ago today as we're recording this. It's actually the anniversary of the discovery.
Oh, wow.
That, yeah, January the 3rd. So I realized that because it was the middle of New Zealand summer, that it was very, very bright late into the evenings, and this was a film projector, that Bruce is probably waiting for it to get dark before we screen the episode, because it would, you know, obviously the... You know, it would have been too light to see it on screen. And so I basically felt, oh, I owe Bruce an apology. So when I actually was talking to Bruce for the first time in years, when we were doing setting up the commentary, so we were all like on video conference, just like we are now, Bruce said, well, thanks for the apology, but that's not actually the case. What it was is he'd invited a friend round for the evening before I think Neil and I had arranged to go around there. So he felt... because he'd arranged for the friend to come around and watch this film with him, that we just had to wait our turn. And that if he wanted to, he could have put blackout curtains up. So the story's changed over the years. The reality is that I was almost on the point of leaving, because it was just an interminable wait for something I just couldn't believe was actually going to happen.
Well, we are recording this on opposite ends of the international dateline. I am 18 hours behind you. So for me, the anniversary of the recovery will be tomorrow.
Yes, I'm talking to you from the future.
What stocks should I invest in?
I'll give you the lotto numbers.
So being one of the first people to watch The Lions since, I guess it would have been early 1965 when it transmitted, you had presumably read the David Whittaker novelization, which we now know changed quite a bit from the televised story. You might have heard the off-air audio. As you're sitting there 24 years ago today, did anything about that episode take you aback or by surprise, something that you weren't expecting to see, or something that didn't play out the way you thought it had played out in the story?
Oh, terrible confession to make. I wasn't that familiar with the story. I had obviously read the novelization. I don't think I'd listened to the audio. I didn't have a lot of the audio soundtracks. I might have done. I'm not a big audio listener. I'm not a big follower, a big finisher or anything. I prefer to read rather than listen. So I tended, although I've got all the missing episode soundtracks, I don't necessarily listen to them all that often. Which is probably a terrible confession to make. But I had the Titan script book of The Crusade that was already out, because I remember showing that to Bruce when we went around there, because he was very interested to see what had happened in the, because he'd watched it over and over again, but he had no idea what happened in the rest of the story. So yeah, I think I showed him that. But no, I wasn't hugely familiar with The Crusade. And I remember... I think Neil had kind of said, oh, I think there's a forest in the opening scene, because that's when we'll know. And the TARDIS has a really odd way of materializing, because you don't hear the usual dematerialization sound and obviously everyone's familiar with just the audio. So when it appears in the forest, Neil's going, we just spent the whole episode in a state of shock, basically, just watching it.
Because I should point out that episode 3, The Wheel of Fortune, had already been available commercially. It was on VHS on the Hartnell Years tape, narrated by Sylvester McCoy.
That's right.
In the early 90s. So looking at your story in TSV 57, which I will link to in the show notes, you guys thought there was a fair chance you would get there and it would turn out to be another copy of The Wheel of Fortune, which we already had.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing was that Bruce wasn't necessarily that familiar with Doctor Who. I mean, for instance, he didn't think there were any missing episodes. He was really quite shocked and genuinely surprised to find that there were episodes. I mean, from his point of view, why on earth would the BBC get rid of Doctor Who? Their flagship show, I mean, for goodness sake, you know. He couldn't quite believe that they'd junked anything. So he wasn't that conversant with Doctor Who. He liked it, he just didn't know it that well. So from his point of view, I've got an episode of Doctor Who and it's you know, from set in the Crusades, you're naturally instinctively going to think this guy doesn't know Doctor Who too well, it's therefore going to be the Wheel of Fortune. You know, so that was in the back of my mind. But the fact he had it on a film print rather than VHS, that kind of go, oh, why would he have the one surviving episode on film print? So that kind of, you know, alerted me to the fact, oh, yes, there's a good chance. Fingers crossed.
Are there any chances of any other missing Hartnell stories resurfacing in New Zealand, such as the more choice bits of Marco Polo, for example?
The problem, I mean, there's two problems. One is obviously three problems. One is so much time has passed, so the chances of finding something in intact or at all is very, very slim. Secondly, New Zealand didn't show all of the 60s stories. There's quite a few that were never purchased, or if they were purchased, they weren't passed by the censor, including The Lion, incidentally. The Lion was never screened in New Zealand. That's the bizarre thing about it.
Oh, wow.
It was brought into the country. It just didn't pass the censor rating. It was too violent. So it sat on the shelf because it wasn't cleared for screening. And the third thing is that we know from having got the New Zealand Broadcasting Corporation traffic logs that a lot of the episode prints that were brought into New Zealand were subsequently sent on to other countries so they could screen them, which process are called bicycling. A lot of New Zealand's episodes went to Singapore, for instance, and Nigeria and places like that. So, there's not a lot to be, once you eliminate all those from, you know, the ones that we either didn't get or sent onto another country, there's not a great deal left that could be found here. Neil, for instance, and I think he talks about this on the commentary, has been investigating for years the possibility that the Macra Terror survives in New Zealand, either complete or individual episodes. We don't know. And his lead for that is that he distinctly remembers as a school kid watching the episodes at his school on a projector because someone had managed to borrow them, presumably from the Broadcasting Corporation, and screen them at schools. And this wasn't uncommon for film prints to be loaned to schools, not necessarily of television programs, but documentaries, all that sort of thing. So it's not completely without merit as a possibility. The real question is, did those episodes stay in the community? Did they get returned? The traffic logs I told you about say they got destroyed, but then so did The Lion. That got destroyed, but evidently someone kept it. So I think destroyed just simply means it's not in the archives anymore. You know, it's not it's not on the New Zealand Broadcasting Corporation shelves. So they basically put it in a truck and said, right, get rid of these. But where did they go from there? Did they go to landfills they were meant to, or does some collector help himself? You know.
So it might still be sitting on the back shelf in the storeroom of a school library somewhere, for example.
Possibly. Like I say, Neil's sort of exhausted a number of options. He's a bit tenacious about this. I mean, we're talking 24 years later and he hasn't given up on it. So he's still investigating leads, but, you know, these things take time. I mean, like I say, I think he talks about it on the commentary, so it's best to hear his side of the thing because I'm only recounting his story secondhand here.
I will have to extend my vacation a day and watch through the next four discs in the Blu-ray so I can get to the Crusade in proper chronological order without messing with the karma of watching stories out of sequence.
Yes, and you'll get to hear from Bruce as well, who will obviously own the film, so you'll get his perspective on things as well. So it's lovely that all three of us get to talk about it.
So we are here today, nominally, to talk about the novelization Doctor Who and the Armageddon Factor. It is a slim book. If you and I were to start reading it page by page out loud, it would probably take about as long as this interview. So we have other things to fill the time before we need to talk about this rather slim book. So I'm always interested in hearing fans' origin stories, and I've told mine on this podcast several times over. How did you first become a Doctor Who fan? How old were you? What story, for example?
March 1975, Spear from Space, Episode 1. My mother, as I mentioned, I was lived in the UK for the first 5 years, and my mother was a teenage Doctor Who viewer, fan, if you like. She watched the series growing up. So when Doctor Who came back on New Zealand television, it'd been away for about 3 years. It hadn't been screened here. And when the Jon Pertwee years started in 1975, I mean, they were a long way behind. Tom Baker was already on in the UK by the time we got Pertwee. So New Zealand was a long way behind at this point. She said, oh, you'll like this. I've watched this one, because she'd watched it when I was two in 1970. And so, but obviously I had no recollection. But so technically I might have been sitting on her knee watching these early stories. I no memory of them. I don't know. But the first one I can genuinely remember watching is Spear from Space, Episode 1. And it frightened me intensely, but in a way, probably like a lot of kids, I was 7 years old at the time, that while I was very, very frightened by it, I didn't want to stop watching. It was a good sort of frightened. It was like, I want to dare myself to actually keep watching this, because it's a really scary series. And so, yes, I just kept watching. And my mother was also responsible for giving me my first Target book not long after that, which was Doctor Who and the Cave Monsters. So obviously another Pertwee story. And at that time, I hadn't read a book that long, and it only had a few pictures in it. So it's kind of like I sort of taught myself to read books of that length by making myself read that book until I could get all the way through it. And I remember in sitting at school in rainy classroom in the middle of winter. And to this day, I have this sensory memory of associating the book with peanut butter sandwiches. Just because that's what I was eating while I was eating my lunch and trying to read this really, really long book with fine print. And so that's my earliest Target memory. And obviously, I just loved that book. And it became a book I read over and over and over again. And from that point on, I don't know why I didn't keep collecting the Target books. But what I did do is I discovered that my local library had a big collection of the hardbacks. So I would just every week, I would just take out as many of those of the Doctor Who books as I could and just read those over and over again. So I became a very voracious reader by reading all the library copies. And then in December 1980, and I can still remember this because my grandmother came to visit from the UK, we went into a bookstore and she said, all you can buy a book to take away, and we're going away on a holiday for 2 weeks. Do you want to buy a book? And I spied a dump bin of Target books. And I thought, oh, these are the books that they've got in the library, only in paperback. And I just watched Destiny of the Daleks on television. They'd just screened. But I'd never seen Genesis of the Daleks because that had not screened. It was one of the stories missed in New Zealand. I mentioned a number of stories of missed in New Zealand. That was one that never screened here. So I said, I spied the Genesis of Daleks novelization. I thought, oh, I want to read that because it's got Davros on the cover and I've just seen Destiny. So my grandmother kindly bought me that one to take away on holiday. And I read it, I think, even before we started on holiday because I just couldn't contain myself. And so while we were away on holiday, I visited a number of bookshops and a guy, there's more of these books. They're everywhere. And so I just started collecting and collecting. Initially, I only went for the Tom Baker books. It had to be a Tom Baker story. And over the course of, well, like I say, it was December 1980. So throughout 1981, 1982, maybe into 83, I just my life's mission, every time I went out somewhere, it was go to the local bookshop, see if there were any Doctor Who books. And eventually, obviously, I got all the Tom Bakers, and then I just Pertwee and then got the rest. And I think by 84, I had everything that had been released by that point. I think by the time Kinder came out, I think that was the last one I needed to get my collection right up to date. And after that, it was just waiting for each new book. So yeah, I just was totally obsessed. And I say totally obsessed, I mean more so than I was with the television series. To me, when I watched Doctor Who, and I did watch it, you know, I did watch it all the time, I would sit there and think, I can't wait for the Target book to come out. You know what I mean? It's kind of like the TV series was there and then it went away. It didn't have a video recorder. So I watched it once and then it was gone forever, supposedly. I didn't dream of the idea I might be able to own them one day. So for me, the Target books were more important than the TV series. It was kind of like that was the end goal. Yeah, we've got these TV stories that I can watch once, but the Target books I can read over and over again. So yeah, they were my obsession.
This is a story that I'm going to tell on the other half of the program when I'm reviewing this novelization. But as an American kid, not familiar with some of the accents or some of the British versus American pronunciations, there were two novelizations that I bought specifically because I didn't understand a word on television. And I wanted to understand what that word was. And then, of course, the word wasn't what I thought it was. One example would have been when Professor Solon in The Brain of Morbius is talking about the laboratory. I'm like, what the heck is a laboratory? And then I bought the novelization on purpose, even though I was not yet mature enough to understand how great Brain of Morbius is. It kind of sailed past me when I was 11 or 12. I bought the novelization because I wanted to know what that word was. And it turns out it's the word that we call laboratory here in the States. And it'll be the same with this book, The Armageddon Factor. I couldn't understand why Drax was calling the Doctor what sounds like Feet, F-E-E-T. That doesn't make any sense as a nickname.
Sure.
And then, of course, the novelization makes that very clear.
Yeah.
And then, of course, lastly, the Sunmakers. I didn't know what Mahogany was, not realizing that was Mahogany. So that was another mystery that the novelization cleared up for me that I never would have gotten from the television.
This comes to something that I wanted to mention to you was, because thinking about this book specifically, as a kid, I was a voracious reader, but I didn't necessarily know every word. And particularly with getting the Armageddon factor, I don't think I'd ever come across the word Armageddon before anywhere. Quite a common word that everyone knows now, but I think back then it wasn't in regular usage. Certainly I wasn't aware of the word. So for a while, because I encountered the word was in the book, I thought it was the Omegadon. I used to refer to it as the Omegadon factor, because that was my reading of the word. And there's a lot of, I can't think of any other examples off the top of my head, but there are a lot of words that I picked up through the Target books that for years, it was my attempt at a pronunciation of it. And then so I'd say it to someone and they'd go, what the hell are you saying? Because my reading vocabulary far outstripped my speaking vocabulary, because I was such a voracious reader as a child. And I guess for a lot of the time, I was doing that very much on my own and not necessarily talking to people very much about what I was reading, that I just developed these sort of weird pronunciations of words. Unfortunately, obviously, my adult life has overwritten all these memories, but just picking up this Target book just triggered that memory of the Omegadon factor.
I will tell you that I had the exact same circumstance. Armageddon is not a word that your average 11-year-old is coming across in school in your basic American education. So when I first got this book, I thought it was. I also said, I told my mother, I'm looking for the Armageddon factor or the Armageddon factor. And she corrected me and I didn't believe her.
Yeah.
I'm also a team Armageddon, same as you.
I cannot remember what I called the Mask of Mandragora originally, but it was something very, very different.
I had that as Mask of Mandragora for a long time.
I think I had Mask-U as well.
Yeah. In The Deadly Assassin, I read the book before I saw it on television, so I had an awful lot of trouble with the made-up word trichophenylaldehyde. I was calling it trichophenylaldehyde.
Anyone would.
So, as you were saying earlier, you didn't get every story in New Zealand in sequence. when did you first see Key to Time, and did you get all six Key to Time serials, or was that something that you watched out of sequence?
They did all play in order. One of the things I've researched over the years is a complete screening history of what's been on in New Zealand and exactly when they aired, you know, looking back through our listeners, which are the equivalent of the UK's Radio Times. We've got all the screening dates and times for every single episode. So that's all up on the New Zealand Doctor Who Club website. So it's all accessible. And so the Key to Time stories did all screen in order in 1980. So they weren't too long behind the UK. So yeah, we got them weekly, one episode a week over the course of that year. And I think I watched most of them. I don't have distinct memories of the Pirate Planet or the Androids of Tara, but there's no reason why I wouldn't have been watching every story. So I must have just, they must not stuck in my memory, but all the other stories from that season, Reboss Operation, Stones of Blood, Power Crawl, Armageddon Factor, they're all, I can remember scenes. I know I watched all those stories. And I think season 16 to, this is terrible, but as a kid, I would be, you'd either be out with your parents and you would have no choice, or you'd just forget, you'd be out playing with your friends and you get home and you realize, oh, Doctor Who was on tonight and I forgot to watch it. So I was that sort of kid that I wasn't very organized into making a specific time to come home and watch it. So if I managed to watch all four or all six episodes of a story, that was quite an achievement for me. It was kind of like, yes, I didn't miss any. So yeah, I was prone to missing them. And I think season 16 was the first time that I really made an effort not to miss any Doctor Who. So it's the first time I was like, I'm going to watch every single episode. I'm going to make a note to myself to make sure that I'm home and I'm watching it. There was a time when Doctor Who screened on Saturday afternoons in New Zealand, and that was obviously an awkward time if you're a kid, because you tend to be out with your family doing things, and you know they're not going to race home in the middle of the afternoon just so you can watch Doctor Who. No video recorders, so if you missed it, you missed it.
See, we had a video recorder at home, but we had a limited supply of VHS tapes. My father gave me one VHS tape that I was just taping over and over again. And after a while, it became an archaeological dig where you would get maybe 30 seconds of Warriors of the Deep in between a story that I taped over and then the next story in sequence. Now, for the longest time, my PBS station would run Doctor Who on Saturday afternoons at 5 o'clock, and they would show all four or six episodes of the story in sequence. And this was a real fright for me because they were still showing Doctor Who on Saturday afternoon 2 weeks before my bar mitzvah, which was Saturday, an all-day affair. And I was very worried that I was going to miss Attack of the Cybermen,
right,
because I was busy having this major religious ceremony. Fortunately, somebody at the PBS station took my religious education into account and moved Doctor Who from Saturday afternoon to Sunday evening, 2 weeks before the event. So I did not, in fact, miss Attack of the Cybermen.
Very considerate.
And it stayed there for the next several years, so I was very lucky on that count. So when you were reading the books as a kid, how important was Terence Dix to you in fostering a love of reading or language?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, I suppose technically you say that Malcolm Holt taught me to read, given that it was cave monsters. But, I mean, I very, very quickly latched on to Terence Dix's very clear style of prose. And I can remember thinking, if Ian Marta wrote a book, or Jerry Davis, or anyone like that, and going, oh, it's not Terence Dix, but they're trying their best. You know, it was kind of like Terence Dix was the standard. He was he defined what Doctor Who was in terms of narrative prose. So he was enormously important to me because he told the story so directly and so clearly and didn't really deviate that much from what was on screen, which was important to me because this was, like I say, it was my record. It was my VHS. It was my copy of what was on television. It was getting the Target novel. It was my permanent copy. So I wanted it to accurately reflect what was on screen. So the fact Terence Dix was doing a very straightforward retelling was really important to me. And something that I've come to appreciate about, I mean, people go through this stage with Terrence Dix, I think. They grow up and they realize that his prose is actually pretty basic, because you get to you move on from target books to more mature fiction, and not saying necessarily Doctor Who, but of any type of fiction, and you go, oh my god, it was so basic, they really are just children's books. And then if you're like me, you come back round to a new appreciation of Terrence Dix later on, when you look back at his work and you realize just how skillfully he gets across the story in a minimal word count, minimal descriptions. He doesn't go into a great deal of description. And he's finessing the dialogue all the way through. If you actually do a line-by-line comparison of what's actually on screen or in the script compared to what's in a Terrence Dix book, he's actually performing like a script editor. He's polishing the lines. He's making them clearer. He's making them read better in prose. And the story is a lot more succinct, and it's a lot easier to follow. So it's not simply, I mean, the cliche that people say about Terrence Dix is just a he said, she said. He's basically just pasting the script and turning into prose. No, he's doing a lot more than that.
And I'm glad you said that, because that's one of the biggest goals that I have with this podcast, because I am going through these books line by line, and I'm trying to prove that Terrence is deceptively simple, but it takes a lot of skill to make the prose come across as simply as it does. And he never uses a run-on sentence. There's no awkward vocabulary.
It's not just a function, I think, of the word count being dictated to him. It's also he's got to manage his time, because he's churning one of these out every month, most months. They're on a monthly release schedule, and he's doing 10, 11 of these a year. I think in the year he wrote Armageddon Factor, I think Ian Marta did Rebels Operation, and maybe one, I don't know if Hinchcliffe's one was that year or the year after, but they're all, other than that, they're all by Terrence, the whole lot. And so he's just like, I'll finish one book, right, next one. That's a punishing schedule.
Keys of Marinus is the book coming out right after this one, so that's going to be the topic of next week's program.
Right.
But I think Terrence wrote 10 books in 1980 alone, and he did the four Key to Time books in 4 months, so March, April, May, June. Stones of Blood, Androids of Tara, Power of Krull, Armageddon Factor, so to speak. So he's writing 480 pages of fiction in 4 months, which is a punishing schedule by any measure.
Yes, and bear in mind, he was also working for the BBC as well, doing television work. I mean, it wasn't so much earlier. He'd been scriptwriting State of Decay, for instance. So, he's got a lot of work on. He's a very busy writer.
Armageddon Factor is a story that sort of polarizes fandom. There is a sort of change in tone between certain actors who are playing it deadly straight and other actors who are playing it just for laughs. And there's also a change towards the end of the story when Douglas Adams comes in and scripts edit the final episode. And that has a different tone to the 5 episodes that have been script edited by Anthony Reed. What is your opinion of Armageddon Factor? Is it a story that works? Is it let down by the production? Is it too funny? Is it not funny enough?
I read the novelization yesterday in preparation for this podcast, but I have to confess I haven't watched the episodes, the television episodes, for several years. So I'm working off a slightly faded memory. But my overwhelming sort of, the reading the novelization does tend to sort of trigger memories of watching the story. And I just remember an awful lot of running down corridors. It seems an awfully padded story. It's probably a 4-parter at best. And it's just a lot of get captured, run away, get captured again. It just seems to drag. It's almost like it was written as a 4-parter and then expanded to 6. Drax feels very shoved in as a sort of like, we've got to keep this going. Let's put another character in here. Because he just pops up out of nowhere for no reason. And he's just there as comic relief. And then he just, okay, I'm off now. It seems like a life of, like, running out of ideas, you know what I mean? He just serves so little purpose. It's just someone for the Doctor to talk to. So, yeah, it is quite a frustrating story, but I suppose when you're watching it as a kid, it's quite quite exciting, because you've been watching this developing story of this quest for each segment of the Key to Time over all these weeks, and the Armageddon Factor was the culmination of that, and it was the mystery of finding out that Princess Astra was this the key to it all, and you're going like, oh, they're finally going to discover it, and it's all just... So I don't remember as a kid feeling disappointed by it. It's only with an adult perspective that I've kind of gone, this just drags, it's very sort of padded, and it's hard to watch all in one sitting.
So when you read the book yesterday, and you had not read it, I imagine, for several years before that, how did the book hold up for you?
Yeah, I haven't read any, I haven't read any Target books in a very long time, because, I mean, I might have dipped into something to look something up, but in terms of reading it cover to cover, I can't remember how many, you know, obviously I've read some of those new Targets they've done, but in terms of the classic Targets, oh, long, long time ago, I'd hazard a guess even maybe 10 years since I've read a Target book, maybe.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was quite alarming. Going, this is such simplistic prose, but yet it's so easy to read. It's so accessible. It's so engaging that I had no trouble reading it. I enjoyed reading it because it was a heady sort of nostalgia, because I know that this would have been one of the early books I owned. And I would have therefore, I had this ritual when I was, sorry, it's a bit of a diversion, but I had this ritual when I was a kid. We'd go away for 2 weeks on camping holiday every Christmas, and I would take all my Target books with me, and I would just read them in story order. So all the books that I had collected, first year I'd only have, say, 7 books. By the second year, I might have 16 books. I'd read them in story order over the course of the holiday. And because Armageddon Factor was one of my early books, I would have read that many times over. So, yeah, it was a huge burst of nostalgia to reread it. It just made me feel like a kid again, you know, 12, 13 years old on a summer holiday reading my Targets. So it's very hard to separate the sort of the pleasurable feeling of remembering being a kid and enjoying the book from sort of an adult perspective of going, is this any good? It's very hard to separate those two things.
Yeah, it is similar for me. Getting these books, and I've told the story on the show before, was an event that would go every 2 weeks, and I would get 2 or 3 books every other Saturday, depending on how much babysitting I had done for my kid's sister. And I would stand there at the bookstore for half an hour with my head cocked sideways, looking at the spines, trying to figure out what I was getting next, with a preference towards new releases or stories that I thought looked awesome in the Le Fissier program guide that I hadn't read yet. And that led to Power of Kroll being kicked down the road until I finally got it as my very last of the original novelizations in 1996. Armageddon Factor I bought early because I wanted to know why Drax was calling the Doctor Feet, F-E-E-T. But it wasn't a book that was one of my favorites. And rereading it for this project, I think there's some very interesting features to the text, because Terrence is not writing to the same texture as the TV story. The TV story does, at times, venture into over-the-top comedy, and Terrence, I presume, is just working from the camera scripts. So he writes this as a much more gritty and dark story than is evident from television, which leads me to an observation. I read Caves of Androzani, the novelization, probably about 3 years ago, before I came upon the idea for this podcast. And I wrote a glowing review of it for the internet. And there was one line of prose in the novelization that struck me as awkward, when Terrence describes the sound of the mudbursts on Androzani Minor as sounding like a million whistling tea kettles. I just couldn't picture why he would say that. And then it turns out, I learned this from your production notes on the DVD, that was a direct lift from a Robert Holm stage direction. This sounds like a million whistling tea kettles.
Sure.
So sometimes Terrence would dip into the camera script for his prose, as well as the script and the locations, the dialogue and the locations.
He would have definitely had the script in front of him. Yeah. But I did, when I was reading it, I was curious, just like you're saying, to see how closely, because I've got all the scripts now. So I got the script for Armageddon Factor and just compared a couple of pages out of curiosity. And that led to my observation that not only is Terrence polishing the dialogue, because it's not a straight retelling of the same line, The line meaning is the same, and the words are mostly the same, but he's just tidied it up a bit. But also he's creating his own descriptions. The descriptions of the sets are very different in his words from what they are in the script. So it's by no means a cut and paste job, but I'm sure if he saw a bit in the description that he liked, such as the tea kettles bit that you're talking about from Androzani, he would have had no hesitation to lift that from the description.
There was a funny story. I think it was Michael Hayes was the director, tells this on the original DVD release, which came out in the States 20 years ago. When he was reading the script, there was a typo, so the word guard was spelled Gurad, and he imagined there was a monster called the Gurads until he learned in context that, no, this is just a typo.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, Terrence in the novelization does not introduce the Gurad monsters.
The Gurad. Someone's got to do that, haven't they? I made a few notes when I was reading. Just some observations I made, if you're interested.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The opening of the story is changed. Because on if I remember rightly, and like I say, I haven't watched the video for some time, that it begins with the propaganda video. With the heroine and the hero emoting, and that sort of then fades out to the screen in the hospital, but Terrence changes it so it actually begins with the Doctor and Romana in the TARDIS. So he's picking up the whole idea of their continuing with their quest. He's establishing the overall narrative of the series before getting into the story proper. And maybe he's doing that because that's how it is in the original rehearsal script, because Michael Hayes actually changed the order of the scenes around. But maybe also he's doing it because it doesn't work nearly so well in prose as it does on screen, because when you watch as a viewer, you're duped into thinking this is the beginning of the story, and it's actually just a teledrama within the story, whereas in prose in the book, that isn't nearly so effective. So Terrence is going, well, I'm not going to make such a big thing out of this. So I can see why he did make that decision to change that realm. And he also makes it something that the marshal is watching rather than something that's in the hospital. And then as part of that, there's a very infamous line that people are very fond of mocking. There's a greater love. Men out there, young men are dying for it. Which is good. They're so loaded with innuendo. But Terrence changes that completely in the book, because he obviously realizes just the line is just ridiculous. So yeah, I think the hero talks about how his friends are dying or something. It's not nearly so loaded as a piece of dialogue.
It's the top of page 8, in fact. Mm. But there is a greater love than ours, and out there, my friends are dying for it.
There you go. Not nearly quite so meaning there.
The double entendre has been smoothed down.
As Terrence is wont to do, yes. The positions of Princess Astra and the Marshal are clarified. We obviously don't necessarily understand on screen quite why the Marshal has so much power over the ruling princess of Atreus. But as Terrence makes the point, as the war has been going on for so long, the military leader has taken over from the royal leader of the planet. So he makes that distinction, which I don't think really comes up nearly so well on screen. I made a general point that he has an economy of description, providing just enough to explain a location, who people are and what's happening, but not bothering to fill in much of the way of sensory details or character backgrounds. So we really don't know where these people were before the story started or what lives they had. We don't know what things like smell like or sound like or anything, because there's very little of that background description. But we get just, it's just an economy. It's just like he gives us just enough to understand what's going on and then moves on with the plot. So we don't get bogged down in description. And the last point I made was coming back to what you said about Theta or Theta Sigma, which in the story is a very intriguing throwaway line, because when you watch the story in isolation from anything else, you're left thinking, is this actually the Doctor's name? It's never actually clarified on screen. Drax refers to him as Theta, and the Doctor says he's Theta Sigma, but he prefers to be known as the Doctor now. So how do you take that? Do you think, oh, is that actually his real name? They move on, right. They never mention it. They never mention it again. And it's a detail that Terrence Dix clarifies in the novelization. saying it's actually a code name. It's not actually his real name. It's actually a line in the book. So you've got this piece of information which you do not get from a screen. And Terrence is obviously going, no, this is unacceptable for the Doctor's name just to be dropped in so casually. It's got to be something else. It's got to be just this code name. It can't be his real name. And many years later, the television series actually picks this up, because in the Happiness Patrol, the Doctor actually repeats this information from the novelization of the Armageddon Factor. So something that originates in the novelization becomes canon.
Right.
Which is beautiful.
Because all the visitors to Terra Alpha are given the last name Sigma. He becomes Dr. Sigma.
Yeah. Yes. And he mentions, oh, that was my nickname at school.
Yes.
So that's kind of lovely, isn't it? That you know, an obscure detail like that from a Terence Dix novelization, you know, has sort of many years later become adopted by the television series as an official part of the mythology.
So much of Doctor Who comes out of Terence's own brain. It's remarkable. And that's another nice little grace note that he can add to his long, long list of unique Doctor Who facts.
He's probably one of the single most important people in the whole history, production history of the series, I think.
I mean, he co-creates the Time Lords. He co-creates the Master. He commissions the Silurians and the Sea Devils and the Sontarans. And it's under his watch that the Ice Warriors go from one-dimensional bad guys to nuanced, perhaps antagonists, but not necessarily villains. And so many other examples beyond that.
He effectively helps rescue the series from oblivion, because it was in very, very grave danger at the start of the Pertwee era, being just dropped altogether by the BBC, and they were actively looking for a series to replace it. So between him and Barry Letts, they basically pulled up the ratings and got it back on its feet again.
And even up to the present day, the last televised story, as you and I are talking, Power of the Doctor, revolves a lot around Time Lord mythology and the Master, and that is all at least partly due to Terence Dix. So even to this day, we are still playing in his sandbox.
And many, many fans will talk about how important the Five Doctors is to them. As a piece of nostalgia, as a piece of much-loved Doctor Who. And Terence wrote that at a furious pace, having, you know, given that commission at very short notice. It's incredible that he did such a good job of it.
I am working on a theory that Five Doctors is probably the greatest classic series episode of all time. That novelization is coming up on this show within the next 6 months, and I'm very curious. I'm going to be exploring that notion when I do that episode. Is it the greatest of all time? Because we've all watched Five Doctors probably more than any other story. We can all probably recite the dialogue from Five Doctors a lot more easily than we could many other stories. I think it has a claim to being one of the greatest ever, even though it was done as a last-minute commission where he's stepping in for somebody else who gave up halfway through, and he has to change around the pairings of Doctors and companions because of external factors that would not have been within his creative control, such as Tom Baker. And for all that, the end result. And then in his new adventures in the 1990s, he goes back and revisits some of the notions from the Five Doctors. So Barusa's fate is revisited. That particular sequence of Time Lords is revisited, such that Flavia becomes president of Gallifrey before Romana does in the books. So Terence cast a very, very long shadow before him.
Yeah, definitely. So, like you say, so much of Time Lord mythology, not just from the War Games and the Five Doctors, but also State of Decay, talks a lot about the bow ships and Rassilon and the War with the Great Vampires. Yeah, that's the sort of thing that, I mean, even DWM's Time Lord Victorious comic strip picks up on that as well. So his contributions to the overall mythology of the series are immense.
And the Ben Aronovich novel, So Vile a Sin, which got abandoned and was then co-written by Kate Orman and released in 1997 after the New Adventures had closed up shop. It was the last one to come out.
Yeah.
That actually features a scene with a great vampire skeleton on a bow ship. So yes. This is an idea that got into a lot of people's heads.
Yeah. He's just brilliant. I'm very fortunate to have met him very, very briefly on a visit to the UK once. And it was very hard to know what to say to him because he figures so much in my childhood as a name who was on all of the books I loved. That what do you say to someone like that, you know, without seeming just a complete idiot? You know, Terence, you taught me to read. Terence, you filled my childhood with joy, you know.
I also got to meet him once when he came to an American convention in 2014. That I brought a stack of novelizations for him to autograph in the dealer's room. And I told him, and I've told the story several times on this show before, it'll probably change in the retelling, but I think I told him that I had read more books by him than by Dickens and the Brontes combined. And he visibly blanched when I told him that, as if that's not what you're supposed to do. but it's the literal truth, and I meant it as high praise. I've read more Terence than a lot of other excellent, you know, legendary canonical writers.
Yeah, I remember getting told off by my teacher for reading too much Terence. We had at school, we had to keep a journal of everything we were reading. It was like sort of, you know, so I guess the teacher could say, well, you know, you're supposed to read one book a week or whatever. And I was reading like one book a day. And so I was filling up this journal with endless target novelizations. You had to write down the title of the book and the author of the book. And it's going, there's way too much books by this Terence Dix person. I think what I was doing, because I was trying to disguise that I really wasn't, you know, I was reading Doctor Who all over and over again, I would just write down that it was called The Armageddon Factor by Terence Dix. I wouldn't put Doctor Who in front of it. So the teacher wouldn't know what that all these books belong to the same series. He'd just say, you need to read other authors, was his feedback.
Oh, that's great. There's a Malcolm Hulk. There's an Ian Martyr. There's a John Luca Roddy. You can find other authors.
But there are too many Terences, though. That's the thing.
So as we wrap up, I want to challenge you to a game of 20 questions. I have selected one random Doctor Who serial from the show's entire run. At random, and using 20 yes or no questions, you are going to guess which story I am.
This could be scary.
Nobody has failed the game yet. One person needed a little bit of help to get in under the wire. Most folks get it in 10 questions or less. And given your familiarity with the classic series, if that's what it is, I don't imagine it would take you a long time to narrow down. If it's a new series story, well... you have episode guides in front of you. I'm curious to see how you do. The record is 6. The record is getting it in 6 questions.
No pressure.
No pressure. So what is your question number 1? How do you narrow down the entire run of Doctor Who from 1963 to 2022?
I'm going to be terribly predictable and ask if you are a 20th century story.
Yes, I am a 20th century story.
Excellent. So it's a classic series, like you say.
Halfway
like you
there.
Say, I'm in my element. Are you a color story?
Yes, I am a color story. So now you've thrown out the entirety of the 1960s. You've now narrowed it down to a 20-year gap of the show, 20 out of 60.
Fantastic. Are you a 1980s show series? Story.
Ooh, I think the record for most consecutive yes answers is 4, and you're almost there. Yes, I am a 1980s story.
Are you a Peter Davison story?
Yes, I am a Peter Davison story. You're 4 for 4. You have a shot. If you want to take one guess and get it in 5, you have a shot at being the all-time record holder. If you want to be a little more methodical, it might take a bit longer.
I'd be throwing away a question here. So I'm Peter Davison story. That's where we narrowed it down to. Am I a season 19 story?
Yes, I am. I am a season 19 story. And now you have a shot at tying the all-time record held jointly by Conrad Westmoss and Pete Lambert.
Oh, dear. Time to take a guess, right? Am I Earthshock?
Oh, good guess, but no, you are. I am not Earthshock. Question 7. So you are guaranteed to win because there are fewer stories left to choose from than there are questions remaining. So I'll give you a hint, since you're guaranteed to get this. It's a story that has already been mentioned during this recording.
Am I Kinder?
Yes, I am Kinder.
That was going to be my next guess anyway.
You got that way too fast. Next time I will challenge you to guess that cliffhanger, which takes a little more time and thought.
A return match.
I have now reloaded the randomizer, and someone else is going to have a dickens of a time guessing what the next story is. And no, that is not a hint.
I'm pleased I got that. I'm usually quite terrible with quizzes.
No, you did excellent. You didn't. You had a shot at the record. You took the long way around, and you got it in 7, which is one of my best scores.
I was listening to the Power Crawl episode that you did just a couple of days ago in preparation for this, and I was listening to your guest on that going, yeah, he's making some very sensible choices there about whittling it down as quickly as possible, and I'm thinking that's the way to go. Try and psychologically halve everything of each question, so you're just narrowing it down until you can make an educated guess.
If you go back to the Invasion of Time episode where I am the guest and somebody else is hosting the show and challenged me to 20 questions, I got it in 8, but it was a lot harder than I thought. It was a lot harder to play than I thought it was.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Paul, I just can't thank you enough for sitting down with me. We're going to get you back on here again in the future, but anything that you want to plug, any place that we can find you, whether it's on a DVD or in a book or in a magazine or on the internet,
I'm most of those places. you can find me in Doctor Who magazine. I write various articles, particularly for the Chronicles series they do, on the comic strips. I'm writing one for the next one right at the very moment. I should be writing that now rather than talking to you.
Well, I'm glad you're talking to me.
Yeah. It's a good distraction. And I'm on Twitter and Facebook and all those sorts of places. I'm obviously working on the Blu-ray, still doing info text for most of the releases. The most recent one that I've done, we mentioned I was on the commentary for season 2. Before that, on season 22, which is still reasonably recent, I did Mark of the Rani and Venus on Varus, the other two I've done on that box set. Are you going to do the modern Targets?
Yes, I am. So in publication order, I'm going to take the Target line to the very end, which I think is Paradise of Death or right around there, maybe the 2 John Peel Dalek epics, and then I will probably loop around and do all of the new series novelizations. And in publication order, I'll also cover the renovelizations of Androids of Tara and Pirate Planet and Stones of Blood and what have you.
It feels like if you do Paradise of Death, you've got to do Ghosts of Endspace as well, even though it's not badged as a Target book because it's the other Barry Letts novelization of a radio serial. But that's getting pedantic, isn't it?
These are all choices, tough choices that I will have to make at some point. And I also have to
cross that bridge when you come to it.
I know that Tony has covered the TSV novelizations, 2 of which you wrote. And I have told you this on Facebook, and I will tell you this now. Your novelization of Resurrection of the Daleks is so much superior to the end result that came out from the actual author of the story, because you took your time to wrestle your way through it and restructure scenes and work through some plot holes, whereas the person who wrote the official novelization was clearly not taking the project seriously.
It's very flattering of you to say so, because you're basically telling someone who was not even nearly as experienced a writer as I am now, because that book I wrote for 30 years ago, maybe long, long time ago, 20, 30 years ago, that you're telling me that what I wrote back then is superior to someone who's worked in television and prose fiction for decades. So it kind of does my head in to receive that sort of feedback, because, you know, I don't really, I don't know. It's complimentary, but I also don't want to be compared to him. You know what I'm saying? He wrote the official novelization. It's his story. He wrote the original script.
But you took the story a lot more seriously than he did in novelization format, so I think the praise is merited.
Okay. Modesty prevents me from agreeing with you.
Well, if you go into my review on the Doctor Who ratings guide, I do have a couple of minor criticisms of the text. That'll keep you on a level head.
Oh, good. Yeah, criticize away.
But on balance, I would much prefer to have yours in canon, so we'll just leave it at that. Paul, yep. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'll make sure we get you back on here real soon now.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Doctor Who and the Armageddon Factor, written by Terence Dix, televised as the Armageddon Factor, teleplay by Bob Baker and Dave Martin, televised in January and February 1979, published in June 1980, cover art by Andrew Skilleter. Some time ago, the White Guardian, one of the most powerful beings in the cosmos, had set the Doctor an urgent task to find and reassemble the six segments of the Key to Time. The Doctor and Romana had successfully retrieved five of the segments, and now they have reached the planet Atrios in the middle of an atomic war to search for the last, most vital piece. Sinister dangers await them in the final stage of their quest. The Armageddon Factor is a novel in the Key to Time sequence. Also available, The Rebos Operation, The Stones of Blood, The Androids of Tara, and The Power of Krull. Thump, 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 thump. Well, they can't all be great. After doing some solid work on the previous three Key to Time novelizations, Terence Dix's adaptation of the season 16 finale, The Armageddon Factor, falls a bit flat. Part of this is due to the TV story's length, six episodes, instead of the more usual four. Terence usually spends three chapters on each story part, but here he's working with roughly the same page count for a six-part story as he got for a four-parter, so cuts had to be made somewhere. Three chapters are recorded for each of parts one and two, but the last four parts all get just two chapters apiece. This does not leave much room for Terence's traditional wry observations, zingers, or plot hole fixes. He begins two straight sentences in Chapter 5 with the identical phrase, "The conveyor belt ran," which is a rare prose misfire for Uncle Terry. In short, this is much less entertaining than Terence Dix's usual fare. The biggest thing I noticed about the early chapters of Doctor Who and the Armageddon Factor is how grim the thing is in tone. Director Michael Hayes brought two things to the TV episode, an over-the-top comic bent with regard to two particular guest roles, David Harries as Shap and Barry Jackson as Drax, and an unusually visually inventive style, such as with the Shadow's conjuring tricks in Part 4, or the Shadow's face superimposed over his exploding space station in Part 6. You won't find that in the book, because this was based on the camera scripts and not the final product. So Shap is played dead straight, with some of his ad-libbed lines on TV, perhaps egged on during rehearsal by Tom Baker, or his blowing canine's dog whistle, if you know what I mean, wink wink. That's absent in print. Canine doesn't spin around and do a complex electronic mating dance in order to access Mentalis. You'll miss late edition laugh lines such as Canine's, "Your silliness is noted."
What are you going to do?
Well, we're going to try and neutralize and dismantle Mentalis here, and it's absolutely essential that while I'm fiddling, it doesn't have to be distracted by an attack from the Marshal. Now, listen. I want you two to go back to Atrios via the transmat. You, Shapper, to contact the Marshal. Tell him he's won. Tell him the war's over. Tell him anything you like, but stop him taking any further action.
And if I can't?
Well, then Mentalis
If the Marshal refuses to listen?
Well, then Mentalis will
go... If he insists on going ahead?
Well, then Mentalis will go into its Armageddon sequence. We'll be bits of dust flying around the cosmos, including the Marshal. You might even tell him that. What are you waiting for?
But what Terence can do is spin a phrase, of course, and that's what makes the book work, just about. Terence elects to write scenes from the Marshal's POV, letting us know just how cynical and dictatorial the man is. Quote, "He knew, of course, that none of these accusations was true. a bombed out hospital ward look like, quote, a scene from hell, end quote. An uncompromising description, probably suggested by stage directions in the camera scripts, undersold by the more comic air to the story on TV. Upon our introduction to Princess Astra, allow the ward, the Marshal sighed, wondering, not for the first time, just how much obstinacy could be packed into one slim body. When Astra is possessed by the shadow and smiles, it's, quote, like a grimace on the face of a corpse. K-9, when solving a problem, gives himself, quote, a mental pat on the back. The Marshal is said to enjoy watching his own speeches on TV. You can usually tell when Terrence doesn't like the script he's adapting. Here, Romana comments on one of the Doctor's war strategies as, quote, utter nonsense, end quote. Draw your own conclusions. Because he's compressing more TV action into the same short page count, Terrence necessarily has to miss out on papering over some plot holes or explaining confusing TV contrivances. No effort is made to explain what Chronodyne is, or why it can temporarily mimic the powers of the still incomplete Key to Time. Even if he doesn't add much by way of humor or insight into the action, though, Terrence certainly can set a scene. His introduction to the Shadow, the story's main villain until the very end, is a masterclass in prose. Quote, the speaker was standing a little apart from the others. At first glance, he looked not unlike them. He, too, was black-robed, with a face like a living skull. But the robes were of some rich velvety material, and a collar of jewels blazed at his throat. Even without these symbols of authority, it would have been evident that this was the ruler of the sinister group. He had an aura of tremendous power and authority, and seemed to radiate darkness so that light dimmed wherever he moved. The voice was deep and husky at the same time, with a note of sardonic malice. It seemed to echo, as if coming from the depths of a tomb. End quote. The Shadow's planetoid is described as, quote, some fantastic castle in space, and the interior has a, quote, strange organic feel, like a rotten apple bored through by innumerable worms. Terrence adds, sardonically, that the Shadow has, quote, traditional tastes in dungeon design. The Black Guardian, once unmasked in the Part 6 material, is a, quote, leering, scowling demon, gibbering with rage. In a short book where you can't waste words, Terrence always seems to find the apt description in the minimum possible word count. Here's another one, quote, the Shadow swept along the corridors of his domain, trailing a cloud of darkness behind him. As cleverly as Michael Hayes directed this thing on TV, that kind of visual could only ever be realized in print. When it comes to the endless war between Atrios and Zeos, depicted by a cash-starved TV production as a video game sequence on a monitor screen, the Doctor, quote, knew that each dot of light that vanished from the screen represented the deaths of a space fighter's crew, young men killed in a senseless war before their lives had really begun. Looking back on it, and I would have read this book when I was about 12 or so, I have to wonder how much of my eventual worldview was informed by passages like these describing the horror and futility of war. Did this book, and others like it by Terrence, help make me who I am today? In one more sense, the book justifies the purchase price. This is one of those stories that I saw on TV before I bought the book, on a later bookstore shopping trip, when I had to choose two or three of some 35 novelizations on the shelf to buy that day. The reason I picked this one, over many others, is because on TV I was fascinated by the fact that Drax called the Doctor Feet, or Feta Sigma. As an American boy, I would have been clueless as to the origins of Drax's accent. Was that the Doctor's real name? I knew that I needed the book to explain that for me. But no, Terrence explains, quote, it wasn't his name. It was a kind of Time Lord coding, quote, and he didn't think he could bear being addressed as Feet for the rest of their association. So I have Terrence to thank for that explanation. And this is my most lasting memory of Doctor Who and the Armageddon Factor.
Hello, Feet. How you been, boy?
What?
This Feet, isn't it? Feet of Sigma. Of course it is. Remember me? Hey!
next time on Doctor Who Alliterature. We are done with Key to Time Month, so we're going to take it back, right back, to the beginning. By August 1980, it had been about 3.5 years since we'd seen a First Doctor novelization. And now we're going to get, for the first time since the 1960s, a new novelization of a Season 1 story. Coming in with his third and final novelization, legendary Doctor Who producer Philip Hinchcliffe is novelizing Serial E. And we're going to have not one, but two guests, one of whom is intimately familiar with the writing of this book. Join us. I promise it'll be more fun than smashing brains in jars, hiking across a frozen tundra in short shorts, or defending a murder victim in a court of law. It's going to be Doctor Who and the Keys of Marinus. Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. Special thanks to my special guest, Mr. Paul Schoons. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at anchor.fm/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels. You can find my old tweets about the entire series under the hashtag Doctor Who Pilgrimage, that's Dr. Who Pilgrimage. My current Twilight Zone watchthrough under hashtag TZ Pilgrimage. And on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.